Your health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
Adam, on our show today, we are going to be talking about speech and language development from children to adults. We've got Dr. Betsy Cray, professor at the University of North Carolina's Division of Speech and Hearing Sciences, to talk about this.
You know, Christy, I think it's really important because I don't think we've really had a guest on to talk about this. And it's really so critical to everything that really people across the country, across the world do. What's normal? What's abnormal? What can we do about it?
Exactly.
Very excited.
It is exciting. And I do want to talk about some research that matters first.
That's also exciting.
About discussions about end-of-life care between doctors and patients.
An important conversation. Mm-hmm. What to do if you think you're allergic to penicillin? Should you just accept it or should you get tested?
About almost one in five Americans who have constant pain, according to a survey.
And then some interesting research that may, and we say may, offer some insight into perhaps some new treatments for those with ALS or Lou Gehrig's disease, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. Let's dive right in with our very first research, Christy, about end-of-life care.
So we have talked before about how important it is to communicate with doctors, preferably in advance, about your wishes and values and determinations that help guide doctors and their nursing staff about what to do when you are at the end of life.
This particular research was in the Canadian Medical Association Journal, and it was 200 older Canadians who were hospitalized with really bad illnesses and an equal number of their family members, and there were kind of 11 recommended elements to perhaps that people could talk about end-of-life care when these elderly people were hospitalized with serious illnesses. And unfortunately, they found that on average, less than two out of these 11 things were actually discussed in the first few days, indicating really missed conversations.
And according to the patients and the families, the top five end-of-life issues that needed to be discussed were care preferences in the event of, like, a life-threatening illness.
Like if you need to be on a respirator or have mm-hmm. CPR. And I bet that was actually done more times
yeah,
than not.
That part's probably done. The patient's values, the prognosis of the illness, their patients' fears and concerns, and then to ask the patients and families if they had additional questions regarding care. Seems pretty straightforward, and those are all very important things, and yet we're not doing that great of a job, I guess.
Yeah, I suspect this isn't limited to Canada, but the glimmer of hope that I think is really important here, and so it might get the right things being done, perhaps for the wrong reasons, but the higher the level of satisfaction of care, the more that these things were discussed, the higher was the satisfaction. Mm-hmm. So if we want to improve our satisfaction scores in hospitals, we should be having these conversations.
Sure, and they really need to remember the best way this is done is to have these conversations with your primary doctor before you're in that life-threatening critical situation so that you can express your own values both to your doctor and your family and write those down.
Yep, good advice. Well, speaking of advice, this next research that matters, Christy, is maybe some advice that might change. I don't know. But this is about people who are allergic to penicillin at some point in time in their lives, oftentimes as a child, or they say they're allergic. And then are they really allergic?
I know. This comes up a lot in the doctor's office of, like, should I list this as an allergy or not? Maybe you had a little mark on your skin. I'm not sure if that's a reaction to the penicillin or not. But yet that bears decisions for the rest of your life. So they took 384 people who were going into surgery and who thought they were allergic to penicillin. And they gave them penicillin skin tests to test the subjects. And then if they came back negative, they gave them a penicillin-related antibiotic.
It turns out not 10, not 20, not 40, not 60, not 80, but 94% of these test subjects did not show an allergy to penicillin. Now, we should say, you know, if you were truly allergic and you were given penicillin, I mean, that can be life-threatening. But it does mean that a lot of people who think they are allergic to penicillin either are not or certainly are no longer allergic.
And so, you know, what to do about that? Some doctors will approach that as, okay, well, let's avoid it if we can. But then if you're in the hospital or if you're in a life-threatening situation and we need to give it to you, we'll go ahead and give it to you in that controlled setting, ready to help your body if your body reacts or freaks out.
And another thing, and this is one I may start doing a little bit more, is actually sometimes referring some of my patients who have a history of penicillin allergy as a young child. Maybe they had a rash or something, and getting them allergy tested and really find out if you are, because if you're not, maybe it's a safer drug than some of the other drugs if you need antibiotics.
That's
interesting
true.
Research.
It raises questions. Okay, this is another research about constant pain, chronic pain. And according to this survey of 35,000 American households, almost one-fifth of Americans said that they battled daily with crippling chronic pain.
Yeah, this was actually in the Journal of Pain, no surprise, in terms of where they're going to publish this particular research. And it was based on a 2010 National Center for Health Statistics survey. And this actually was not the people who have, like, you know, arthritis that happens every other day. But this is people who are really suffering from chronic multiple health conditions that lead them to experience chronic pain. And the problem is we don't want people who have this type of chronic pain, all of them, to be on chronic opioid therapies or chronic drug therapies, because we also know that in the United States, we give out 80 to 90% of all the opiates in the world. So there are a lot of other modalities, because chronic pain is a bad thing to live with.
Yeah, so it's sort of a paradox. We've got all these people with pain, and then we've also got all this overprescribing of these opioids, which ultimately doesn't fix the problem. They have a role, but we're overprescribing that, and yet we don't want people to be in chronic pain.
So there's things like physical and occupational therapy, exercises, dietary changes, weight loss, massage, psychotherapy, acupuncture, yoga, lots of different things that can be done. I'm really excited about really trying to have a team-based approach.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that. Okay, let's talk about this last research, and this is about a blood pressure drug in the category of these ACE inhibitors, the angiotensin-converting enzyme inhibitor medications like lisinopril, enalapril, ramipril. What am I missing? Any of the prills. This medicine being linked...
We'll just call them ACE inhibitors.
ACE inhibitors being linked with some protection from ALS or Lou Gehrig's disease.
Yeah, you know, there's only one drug out there that's actually right now used to treat Lou Gehrig's disease. And so everyone, because of the, you know, it's on everyone's attention, at least in the United States, across the world, and they had this ice bucket challenge. My wife and I did it as a couple earlier this summer.
We donated.
It was cold. But yet, you know, more research. And this is some research. And this was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association subspecialty journal called Neurology.
And basically, they found this possible, this link, where if people were on the ACE inhibitors for more than 4 years, it appeared to reduce their risk of ALS by 57%.
Particularly if they were taking a higher dose of that ACE inhibitor, and it was a dose response, the higher the dose. Now, that doesn't mean that people with ALS should go out and take an ACE inhibitor, does it?
No. I mean, this is not a cure for ALS, and it's not an established prevention for ALS. So, but it may have a role. If people on this medication are somehow protected from it, then there's some link there, potentially,
maybe
that could help us understand what could prevent people from getting in.
Right. So we think it's a research that matters because it brings some hope to an area that doesn't have a lot of hope of kind of the next round of research. So that'll conclude the research that matters, Christy. But we're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we're going to be talking with Dr. Betsy Cray, professor at the University of North Carolina's Division of Speech and Hearing Sciences, about speech and language development from children to adults. You're listening to Your Health. Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page will be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're talking with Dr. Betty Cray, professor at UNC, University of North Carolina's Division of Speech and Hearing Sciences, about speech and language development from children to adults.
Welcome, Dr. Cray. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
You know, this is one of those topics, speech and language development, that is really sexy. And by that, I mean it's something that's so important to all parents, you know, all adults, and yet I don't think we talk about it very much. And Christy and I recognize we hadn't had anyone on the show in years. So first off, thank you for the work you're doing, and thank you for being on our show.
Appreciate it. I like being here.
Now, you've been in this career in speech pathology for nearly 30 years.
Actually, almost 40.
40 years. Yeah. Well, tell us, what sparked your interest in the early phase of your career?
Well, in high school, excuse me, I'd done some public speaking and just got interested in talking with people, communicating. And then when I was in college, I was an education major in communication studies and kept seeing all these clients or patients in part of the building and kept thinking, gosh, why are they there? And so I took an elective over on the other side of the building in communication disorders, and a few days later called my parents and said, this is it. I finally found what I want to do for the rest of my life, and that's be a speech pathologist. And the main reason is because you can really work with any age of child or adult across all kinds of settings, hospitals, rehab centers, schools, private practice, and then with all kinds of disabilities, autism, stroke, traumatic brain injury, and on and on.
Well, I know when we say speech pathology that we're talking about abnormal things that are happening with speech, and I hope that your parents said, really, with excitement. But help us understand, what is the normal speech? When we say speech, we say language. What are we really talking about? Let's make sure we're talking about the same thing.
Great. Well, when we talk about speech, we're usually just talking about the way we talk. So things like articulation. How do you articulate your words? Are you fluent? How is your voice sound? Those are the kinds of things that make up the speech part of it. And then the language part of it is really how we understand each other and how we put our words into meaning and understand meaning with each other, and how we put our words together. And so across languages, we may use words that are different, obviously, and we have different meanings for some words.
Use that word articulation. Not an easy word to say. I think I can spell it okay. Tell us exactly what that means, though, and give us an example.
So that means for the very young child who might say wabbit for rabbit with a W, that would be a form of articulation error. We know what the word is, but we just don't know exactly how the child says it. And so if you said wabbit and somebody might not understand it, then you might want to have that sound or correction.
But we sometimes think that's cute, don't we?
Exactly.
You know, when children say words a little bit off, but that – when does it evolve from something that's cute to something that maybe it's not okay?
Well, I think there are several things to think about. We talk about articulation as at about 2, you should be able to understand about half or 50% of what a child says. At about 3, it's about 75%. And about 4, you should be understanding all the words. Also, I think you want to be thinking about if there's a time that someone teases the child or almost ridicules the child and that becomes sensitive to the child, then it's probably always time to get somebody to take a look at that child's speech.
And so thinking now that we're talking about children and their development, a lot of parents are either worried early on that their child might have a speech delay when in fact it's part of normal development. And other parents are like, oh, it's cute, or he's just quiet, when there may really be a problem. And people are very worried about autism and those early signs. How do you advise people on an approach to normal development and when to get assessed, and how young should they get assessed?
Well, that's a great question.
Lots of questions, but
yeah, that's a great series of questions. There's several things. One, the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, on their website under milestones, they have lots of milestone pages. So generally about broad development, people can find out sort of how typically developing their child is. Also on each of them, if you look at the 3-month milestones, over in the corner, there's a place for red flags. If your child isn't doing these things. So that's a great resource.
Like what?
If your child isn't making sounds or looking at you and kind of cooing back and being sort of interactive, not talking yet, but still making sounds and looking and smiling. And
as a young child, not a teenager.
Yes, no, no.
A teenager doesn't look at me or coo at all.
Exactly. No, that's why I had said it 3 months. If you looked at the 3-month checklist.
Then it fades out and they don't want anything to do with you.
Yeah. And then the other place to look is the American Speech Language Hearing Association is another place where you can go, and they have great milestone lists. So good cue you into what you might expect for children.
We can link that to our blog.
Yes.
So what prevents a child from having normal speech or language development? Is this an issue that the parent's not encouraging the child, or is it all innately with the child?
Well, there's certainly some interaction, and, you know, we've had those wars for a while, that sort of innate versus environment, and I think we're recognizing that some combination of both. So hearing loss is always a concern, and so if any parent feels like their child may not be hearing or responding, certainly go see their primary provider and or an audiologist and have that checked out. Other kinds of things. You mentioned, Christy, autism, and that's certainly the prevalence of autism is continuing to rise, and so we want to be aware of that. And autism is very much a social issue, looking at social skills. And so it might not be this child who's necessarily shy, but who really isn't caring or interested in interacting with others as much, isn't making eye contact, isn't gesturing, isn't starting to make sounds. And like we talked about, the three-month-old who's looking back and smiling and very engaged with the parent. A child with autism may be actually sort of looking away and not be as responsive.
And, okay, so let's take that three-month-old who's looking away and not as responsive. What is sort of the best trajectory for this child in terms of getting assessed and waiting and encouraging the child to do more? And then at what point do you get further evaluation? And what's the best care for that child?
Well, I think first, if a parent is concerned at any age, they should go to their primary care provider and talk to that person, because that person is skilled in looking for developmental issues. So I think that's a place to start. Childcare providers, particularly who routinely see lots of kids, whether it's daycare or early start or Head Start and some of those programs, they're skilled at looking at lots of two-year-olds, lots of three-year-olds. So they can be helpful judges, too, to help parents know. And then, of course, lots of parents go to the Internet and start looking up some of these milestones to make decisions about whether to refer. You know, I think it's not ever too early to refer, because in most states, the early intervention system, mm-hmm. any child can get a screening, and so it's not that big of a deal in some ways to go ahead and, if you're concerned, to get a screening. And what I try to tell the students that I work with, and sometimes the residents here, you know, by the time a parent has come to you, they've already probably done the wait and see. They've looked, they've thought about it, they've mm-hmm. asked their neighbors, their mother-in-laws and sisters and whoever else, and they've probably already done some wait and see. So if a parent brings it up to a professional, it's probably something to take a look at.
You know, you mentioned earlier about an articulation problem, let's say, for a child who may be having problems with wabbit or the R, but there are what other sorts of articulation kinds of sounds might be difficult for that child? And are there some simple things that a parent might be able to do to help before they go and do the referral, especially? What are things they could do at home to help out with, and what are the range of articulation sorts of things they might encounter?
Well, the hardest sounds are L, R, and S, TH. Those
are like the types of words, lollipop?
Exactly. So L, lollipop, or light. And so you'll often hear children say white for light. S's, children may...
Snake, they would say.
Snake or something sort uh-huh. of off and distorted, uh-huh. or completely leave it out. Say, that's a nake, rather than snake.
Okay.
And so those are fairly common, and usually by the time children are 6 or 7, they've outgrown those kinds of articulation issues. Again, anytime the kid's being teased or is starting to feel shy and hesitant to talk, it probably is a good time to have the child referred. Now, for children birth to 3, they can be referred to the early intervention system here in North Carolina. Once they turn 3, they can be referred to their local school district, and so the school district can do the screening.
That part gets a little bit confusing. I hope we'll revisit that after the break. We do need to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. Betsy Cray, professor at University of North Carolina's Division of Speech and Hearing Sciences, about speech and language development from children to adults. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
You UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Betsy Cray, professor at the University of North Carolina's Division of Speech and Hearing Sciences, about speech and language development from children to adults. And Dr. Cray, you were mentioning before the break about some of the letters that children can either misspeak or misarticulate along the way that tends to get better as they get older. And that brings me to this concept of a lisp. And what I'm realizing is some variation in families and in personal experiences and their thought about how much a little bit of a lisp is cute as people grow up and how much it's, how important it is to extinguish that and at what age it's important to do that. Tell us the range of what you see.
Well, we see quite a lot of range. And in fact, you probably see broadcasters on national television occasionally who, in sports and otherwise, who might have a little bit of a lisp.
Sure.
And I think, yeah, I think you're right. We do have to decide culturally within each family and with each family member, to what degree does that become a problem or an issue for that person? And again, I mentioned earlier, if anyone is ridiculed or made fun of, then we definitely want to tune in to getting some help. And lisps are not necessarily easy, but they're fixable with some good speech therapy, either preschool, before school, or during school, or after. I mean, I've worked with adults with lisps and other kinds of articulation disorders because they wanted to be comfortable and feel good about how they speak.
And can adults retrain their tongues and their mouths?
Yes, yes, absolutely. You know, I mean, the brain is all about motor planning and motor programming and sort of how you put things together. And just like we can retrain ourselves, if we have a broken arm, we can write with our left hands, and it begins to get better as we work at it, and your articulation is the same.
Now, my family would say I actually need to retrain a lot more about my speech, but let's just pretend for a second that you're working with a teenager or maybe an adult who has a speech or language disorder. Help us, give us some example of some exercises that you might do with someone like myself who would be coming to you. Help us understand the types of things that are actually being done.
Well, primarily, one of the things would be to do is to help, particularly the tongue is really important. And I've worked with cancer victims who've had parts of their tongues removed, or tobacco smokers who've had parts of their tongues removed, and so they need some retraining. And so part of it would be helping them understand how they are speaking now and how they might like to speak. So you might do audio recordings, and I can see some of your equipment here doing that kind of thing. And also,
so that they're hearing it?
So that they're hearing it and hearing how they produce it.
And how does that change their ability to then speak differently?
Well, then they could move their tongue in different places and watch change.
Okay.
And also hearing it. So then we would practice doing different things. Let's move a little this way. Let's move a little this way. Make your tongue a little tighter, more toward the front, more toward the back. But from a parent perspective, you know, the best idea is really not to devote that much attention to it necessarily, but then to just repeat the word as you might say it. So if the child says wello or wewo for yellow, you could say, yes, that is yellow, very nicely articulated, little visual on your face so that the child could look and see how you produced it. And that's how I might begin with young children in particular. It's just that sort of giving a really good, strong model to them, not making it be a big deal. But then, of course, as people get older into young teenagehood or adulthood, they're certainly ready to sit down at a table and look in a mirror and talk about how to practice those kinds of sounds.
And do you still send children saying Sally sold seashells?
Or Peter Piper picked. Yes, that's what I was just thinking of.
Seashells also soon.
No, not particularly, because even in those of us who are fairly articulate, those are going to cause us to be not articulating well. So, but we would do things that would be much more functional about what words they'd be using for their age range and sentences and combinations of words.
So let's take on a little bit further on the spectrum. So people who have children or adults that are becoming with, you know, more profound hearing loss, and you're working with them on speech and language, or even into more difficult processing, like autism spectrum disorders. Help us understand the things that you do for those types of populations.
Okay, so for older kids, there are now lots of things, biofeedback and other kinds of things, acoustic measures that you can actually visualize and see. And so that's a helpful process. For kids with autism, I would probably not work as much on sounds as I would getting the words right, being able to attach the right words and the right objects together. Children with autism typically have social and communication difficulties, and so they may not be as interested in sort of learning our language, so to speak. And so rather than worry about how they sound, I would be really focusing on getting their words and getting their words connected.
Give us an example of how that might work.
So I might say, you know, be holding something and call it a doll, and a child with autism may not have a word for it. And so I would want to help them. Oh, here's the doll. Let's play with the doll. You know, can you kiss the baby doll? Let's hold the baby doll. Let's put the baby doll tonight. So you can hear how many times I've said baby doll in just those short sentences. So sort of pumping in, so to speak, the words that you call these things.
And I know this is shifting gears just a little bit, but you're doing a lot of research, and we're speaking about autism, doing a lot of research with autism, particularly in the very, very young children. What is the most exciting thing that you've discovered recently that may be, or that you and your team and other researchers have discovered that may be helping us understand autism?
Well, I work with a group of researchers called PEARLS, and it's the Program for Early Autism Research Service, Learning and Service. And there are five of us, Grace Baranek, who's an occupational scientist, Linda Watson, who's a speech pathologist, and I am, and two developmental psychologists, Lauren Turner-Brown and Steve Resnick. And the group of us are working on some pretty exciting things. One of those is a early screening tool called the First Year Inventory for 12-month-olds. It's a parent screening tool that parents fill out. And then we look at it and take a look. And the children who score most high risk for autism, we want to bring them in and take a look at them. And we've just finished an early intervention study using the First Year Inventory to identify kids at risk and then bring them in for early intervention. We bring them in for assessments and do a randomized control where half the children get a home-based treatment. So half of them go get our home-based treatment. Half of them get referred to the early intervention system in the community. All the kids get referred to the early intervention system, but some of them just get our extra dose of home-based intervention, where we're really working with the parents to help them engage their children, keep them engaged so they don't sort of turn away and be less social, that we are teaching them all kinds of baby games and childhood games to play with their kids.
You're a professor. You're a clinician, you're a researcher, and you're a mother, from what I understand.
Right, that's right.
As a parent, I would imagine that you have this parental instinct that you really want to fix these things quickly. How quickly can you really make interventions? And can you really help most people who come to you? Because, I mean, I'm getting this sense of, like, this is really hopeful. Things have progressed a long way. Think back. What is the biggest challenge, and where do you really see things going?
Well, it is exciting, and yes, I'm feeling that too, and it's one of the great things about doing what I do, as you say, professor, researcher, clinician, and mother, is trying to help these young families and their young children and finding out who then might be at risk for autism to get them into some early intervention. Because we do know that for some people, we talk about sort of unfolding of autism, that for kids might start out looking a little better and things aren't looking so great, or they might sort of start slowly and then keep slowly. Well, we want to accelerate their learning as much as possible so that we can make these early times as most productive so that they can get farther in life. And so for me, it is exciting to try to find these young families, find their children, and begin to get them the kinds of services they need so the kids can get the most out of really their whole lives.
Well, so there's a message of hope and a message and really catch them early with early intervention. And are you starting to see some promise from your work that by catching them even earlier that there is more advancement for their lives?
Yes. We and other research groups around the country and other countries are starting to see that if you can kind of catch these kids early and keep them engaged, mm-hmm. keep them wanting to learn and be watching and learning from their parents, then they're going to be much more able to communicate and learn over their lifetimes.
Wonderful. Wonderful. That offers hope to a lot of people.
And for our parents and listeners and grandparents that are, you know, all over North Carolina, all over the United States and internationally, how do they find resources that they can are accessible, maybe affordable to them?
Well, good point. All right. So here in the United States, the early intervention system, every state has one. And if you just Google early intervention North Carolina, you will come to the early intervention website.
Great. We'll put that on our website.
Yeah. There are sites all over the country and in every county. And then at the school level, as I mentioned, once a child turns three, anyone can go to their local school district, look them up on the web, and say, I'm concerned. I have a problem. I would like to get my child screened and get a screening.
That's great. And would that also include people who are immigrants or undocumented aliens? You know, would it include most populations that as long as they can access the school system?
Yes, exactly. Yes.
Great.
That is great. Well, thank you for the work that you're doing. Thank you for sharing and for giving our listeners and us a message of hope.
Thanks. Great to
thank
be here.
You. Thank you very much.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we get to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and your concerns.
And Christy, if our listeners have any questions they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, they can send their comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our executive producer, Erica Norrie, to read us our House Call questions today that span the spectrum from the shoulders to
the feet,
to all parts of the body. Erica, what's our very first House Call?
Since my doctor changed to a new computer system, he's been asking me questions he didn't ask before about home safety and personal health goals, for example. Sometimes it just seems too much. Why has it changed? I prefer his previous line of questioning.
Ooh. I think that's a pretty direct comment there that I can give you some guesses, but because we got this new EPIC system, which... What does EPIC stand for, Christy?
I don't know.
Environmental.
I don't think it stands for anything. I think it's just EPIC.
It's a computerized major healthcare system for which we get prompts to actually ask what we call best practices, evidence-based things that we're supposed to do, but we get lots of these prompts.
And there is more of a movement through these computer systems to encourage doctors to ask patients to engage in that process more, to help set your own personal health goals. So it's not just us telling you to exercise more, but getting more specific to say, okay, so what's your goal when you say you want to exercise more? What does that mean for you? What's the barrier to that? How can we help encourage you in the right way? So some of those questions are geared to help engage our patients more meaningfully.
Which is all good. Though sometimes
unless
also,
you don't want it.
Yeah, unless you don't want it. And sometimes actually now physicians are actually get reimbursed or get a little higher reimbursement if they do these things too. So we have to be really fully mm-hmm. honest and transparent in everything we do. But in that interest, I'm going to encourage you to talk to your doctor. Tell your doctor that in the move towards whatever has changed, mm-hmm. something is not good. Something is amiss here.
Yeah.
Like they're not focusing on you as much.
Exactly, because sometimes the prompts might be saying to ask questions that really aren't relevant to you. And so being able to have that conversation with your doctor, like, I don't want to spend my time talking about, you know, which vegetable I had for lunch, and I'd rather spend my time talking about
my knee
pain.
Or what are the barriers to me not getting a flu vaccination when I really want to talk about...
Right, something else.
How I can... get my cholesterol down without drugs.
Right. And so bring that up to your doctor. I think your doctor would welcome it and say, I'm so sorry. Let's focus on you.
Yeah. Maybe you'll put that computer down and just look at each other a little more. Good thing. What's our very next house call, Erica?
My son sometimes complains of his feet hurting when he walks or runs. At 7 years old, he doesn't let this hold him back from sports or any other activities. But it worries me. Are these growing pains or should I seek a specialist?
I think maybe your son's maybe he's closer in age to me. I can certainly relate to those feet things, but wait a second, he's only 7.
Yeah, it does seem unusual for him to have both feet hurting, but also continue to be running and exercising, which to me says it's not bothering him that much. If he's mentioning it to you, but it's not holding him back from doing things, that's a good sign. It could be growing pains, and it's less likely to be plantar fasciitis at age 7 years old, or you know, major problem with his arches.
That inflammation in the feet. You know, Christy, one of the wisest teachers of mine in medical school told me once that 90+, 95% of all foot problems were problems with
the arches,
the shoes. So I would take a look at those shoes and make sure that the shoes, you know, when's the last time those shoes were replaced? Or maybe they're running in not tennis shoes. And right,
maybe he's got some blisters on his feet or something that's hurting,
or a callus. Or warts or something. Look at the shoes, look at his feet. Take it into the doctor, and hopefully things can get better.
Sounds good. Get good shoes.
You don't want to be my age and have feet problems. You know, or cut back on the running.
Right.
Could be.
Yeah, I'd say just take a look at those things. Bring him into his regular doctor and just have him take a look. And it might be just give it a little bit more time. Maybe he'll run it off. Or maybe the new shoes will do the trick.
Never hurts. Erica, what's our very next house call?
I'm 68 years old, and I'm having trouble with constantly feeling like I need to clear my throat and cough. I thought it could be my blood pressure medication I'm on, Lisinopril. And now I'm doing a trial off my medication to see if it makes a difference. What else should I be doing?
Awesome question. And unfortunately, this is having what we consider to be a chronic cough or chronic clearing of your throat can come from several different things. And one of them is this class of blood pressure medications called lisinopril or enalapril or those ACE inhibitors we talked about earlier on the show. They can cause a little bit of a cough.
Yeah. Can we rank our expert, Dr. Cray, back on the show? Because we really need her right now, Christy. Help us answer this. But, you know, there are a number of things that can do this. Sometimes reflux of acid, particularly as we get older, or we're taking medicines that make reflux more likely, and that acid kind of just irritates our vocal cords.
Yeah, it can. Sometimes it doesn't feel like burning. It just makes you have that little bit of a cough. It also could be from allergies or chronic allergic rhinitis, or when you get allergies in your nose causing some post-nasal drip where that mucus kind of drips down the back of your throat and just tickles your cough sensor just enough to keep kind of clearing your throat.
Yeah. Good luck. Look into all these things. Probably go see your primary care doctor. And most of the times, this can get better. Sometimes they have to actually take a look down in your vocal cords, particularly if like you're a smoker or drink too much alcohol, because that may be a worrisome sign.
Mm-hmm. Good luck to you, and great question. Thank you for sharing.
What's our very last house call, Erica?
I'm 40 years old and have pain that comes and goes in my right shoulder towards the front of my body. I like to exercise on a regular basis, but it gets worse when I do pull-ups or push-ups. It does get better when I rest, but I'm trying to be healthier and exercise regularly, so I try not to rest too much. What could it be?
What do you think, Christy?
Oh, that's a tricky one. It sounds very, very familiar because I've had trouble with my shoulder, too.
Which shoulder?
My right shoulder.
Oh, you think is your problem the same as our listener?
Yeah, it sounds very similar.
What was your problem?
I don't know.
Did it get better?
Yeah, it did get better just with time. I'm not quite sure what made it better.
Was it when you were doing, because I remember like last year you were doing this like CrossFit. Iron Woman thing with weights and everything.
Yep. I do. I'm still doing CrossFit like crazy, which is great for me and my muscles and my body. But when you have a little nagging part of a knee or shoulder or something, it can be frustrating when you want to exercise, as this listener does, but you don't know exactly how to make that pain go away.
Well, it's probably what's called an itis. Tendonitis or myositis. It's an itis, an inflammation of something right around that area. And push-ups and pull-ups put a lot of strain and stress on the shoulders. Probably not arthritis, even though that's a type of itis, because that would be a little bit older.
Mm-hmm.
It could be, you know, sometimes people actually separate their shoulder. It's a little small joint in that shoulder. I did that once. I won't say what happened in college, but I did fall off a bunk bed late at night. separated that shoulder. And sometimes then that can be irritating. You may not even know you've done that. Mm-hmm. So this
you
is
can have a little bit of a rotator cuff tear, just
that's
like
right.
not so much that you can't move your arm, but just enough that it's just a nagging tear.
So we would encourage you to
see. It could be from a bursitis, capsulitis.
Your doctor, see a sports medicine doctor. Go see someone. You know, if simple kind of cutting back doesn't do it, because you may be not knowing what's going on here.
Right. And it may be that you're not resting it quite long enough, which was one of the things that helped me, was just to give it a good 2 weeks of not doing those aggravating things to help it get better. We wish you all the best and hope your shoulder heals up so you can keep exercising.
We want to thank everyone for joining us today on Your Health. We hope we've addressed questions that are important to you. If you want to, you can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or our health app. Search Your Health with one word.
We want to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Betsy Cray. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page, and we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.